And then spend about half the class talking about an example which you're all going to present to me today. And we'll try to work through that in real time so you know there's no smoke and mirrors, that we can actually apply this stuff to just about any problem. So we talked about the three basic problems associated with hidden Markov models. And the one that we're immersed in now is called the learning problem. How do we estimate the parameters of the model? And we talked about for discrete distribution, we could estimate the transition probabilities using a ratio of the gammas summed over time divided by the gammas summed over time and summed over all the states. And then we talked about the fact that we could estimate the output probability distribution as essentially a sum of the gammas for the situation under the constraint that a particular symbol was output divided by the sum of the gammas at that state. So we ended up with a way to re-estimate the transition probabilities and the output probabilities. What we want to do today, well, then we talked about how we could replace our discrete distribution at each state in the Markov model with a continuous distribution. So instead of having a vector of probabilities, one for each symbol, we're now going to postulate a multivariate Gaussian distribution, and we're going to have to worry about how to estimate the means, the covariances, and the mixture coefficients of this multivariate Gaussian distribution. And we also talked about this is a nice technique, but it does increase complexity significantly. And over the years, we've developed some good techniques to deal with that. And we'll talk about those kinds of things a little bit more in the speech recognition class. So what I want to do over the next couple slides is just sketch out the derivation of the re-estimation equations for these parameters. The actual derivations are quite long and not easy to condense into a small set of slides. So I've got links on the main page on the title slide to the complete derivations of these equations if you want to read further about that. So we can write the joint probability of the data and the states given the model as the probability of a sequence V superscript T. That's essentially a sequence of T output symbols. And omega are essentially the states given the parameters of the model theta. And that's going to be the product over time. All we have to do to get this probability is to essentially compute it at each point in time and multiply those probabilities together. So we can take the product from T is equal to 1 to capital T of the associated transition probabilities transitioning from the state at T minus 1 to the state T times the output probability at that state. So we have you can think of this as AI comma J, only instead of I, we're using the state at omega of T minus 1 and omega at T. And then we have times the output probability at that state, omega T, for the specific symbol that was output at time t. So we write that as v sub t. And we can further expand this using the we can further expand this in terms of the Gaussians that we have, because we have the mixture coefficients that we have at each state. We have essentially a sum of these Gaussian distributions. So we can write this in terms of the transition probability and the particular Gaussian for that symbol at that state times the associated mixture coefficient. So this is a rather complicated expression, but it tries to express the probability of the observation sequence in terms of each and every corresponding mixture component. Now, one of the interesting things about the mixture model is that when you have a sequence of feature vectors and you're trying to map those feature vectors to particular states, if you remember, this is a hidden model, so we don't know which feature vector was produced by which state. In fact, all states could produce any combination of feature vectors. So the reason we end up with all these sums is we have to sum over all states, because any feature vector could have been produced at any state at any time. Isn't that wonderful? And then, on top of that, the same thing is true with the mixture distribution. It's the weighted sum of Gaussians. We're not saying that one particular component of that Gaussian, of that mixture distribution, produced that feature vector. That feature vector could have been produced by every one of the components of that mixture distribution with some probability. So we have to sum over all those probabilities as well. So we end up with a lot of summations, but it'll all work out to a fairly simple set of equations, which is kind of amazing to me. But that's why this technique has been so powerful. So this can be considered the sum of the product of all densities with all possible state sequences and all possible mixture components. And we can write that as the probability of V to the V superscript T, which denotes the observation sequences, omega, which are all possible state sequences, and K, which are all possible mixture coefficients given theta. And that's simply the transition probability from omega at T minus 1 to omega sub T, omega of T. So that's just the transition probability when we move from one state to the next, times the output probability at that state for the K sub T mixture, times, and for the V sub T symbol, times the corresponding mixture weight at that state for that mixture component. And then we can write that the overall probability, P of V superscript T given theta. So this is the thing we want. This is the probability that that's a particular sequence. And remember, we're worried about training here. So in training, you're going to have a particular sequence of data. You know what it is because it's been labeled. And you want to know what is the probability that my model could have produced that sequence, that specific sequence. So you have the probability of V superscript T, that's the sequence or the training data, given theta, that's the model. And that can be written as sort of re-expressing this as the sum over all possible state sequences over all possible mixture components of this probability of that where we express the probability of the sequence given a particular state sequence and a particular set of mixture components. Now, what we're going to try to do, one of the reasons I wanted to go through this is to sort of show you how we apply the EM theorem to the problem of estimating the parameters. So we're going to set up our auxiliary function Q. If you remember from the EM derivation, we have the probability of T of the state sequence T given Y for the model theta prime times the log of that probability for the model theta. So that we can write as the sum over the state sequences, the sum over the mixture components of this P of V superscript T given comma omega comma K given theta. That's the probability for a particular state sequence, a particular set of mixture components, divided by the total probability, which, and we wrote both these expressions on the previous slide, times the log of the probability of superscript T omega K given theta. So we have essentially probability, we have this function times the log of this function divided by the total probability. Now, this, if the log of this probability, let me go back the previous slide. Logs and probabilities, of course, always kind of work out nicely together. So because we have the product here, the log of the product is going to be the sum of the logs. So this term can be decomposed into the sum of three terms. We have the sum of the transition probabilities plus the sum of the output probability distributions plus the sum of the mixture components. And the auxiliary function, so this auxiliary function then has essentially three components. It's got a component related to the transition probabilities, a component related to the output probabilities, and a component related to the mixture coefficient. Now, that's very fortuitous, because that means when we're going to now have to differentiate this with respect to transition probabilities, with respect to output probability distribution, with respect to mixture coefficients. Now, if this was not decomposable into three sums, when we differentiate with respect to the transition probabilities, we'd get some mess because it'd have all the other stuff in it. And that would, and similarly, if we differentiated with respect to the means and variances of the Gaussians, we'd get all this junk in it. So the fact that this is separable is very important, because that means when I take the partials with respect to those parameters, the other terms go away, and I'll get a clean set of equations. So when I take the partial of this with respect to the A's, what happens to these two terms? They go to zero. And when I take the partials with respect to the B's, these go to zero. So that decoupling is very important. And in fact, the first term here, if you differentiate this and go through the derivation, you'll end up with the equations that we previously described for re-estimation of the A's. So that's kind of interesting, because that says when we introduce the continuous distribution model, the way we re-estimate the transition probabilities doesn't change, and you would expect that. They should not be a function of the type of model you're using for the state. And then we have these remaining two terms now. We have a term associated with the output probability distributions and a term associated with the mixture weights. The term associated with the output probabilities, this is just the sum over time of the probability that we're in state J at time t, and we output the kth mixture component at time t, given our observation sequence and our model parameters. So we can sort of write this in a fairly compact way. And we can do the same thing for the mixture components. So what's interesting about the continuous distribution model is the only real thing it adds to the model is at each state now, instead of doing a one way you can think about it is the following. You have this training data, and you go through and you somehow align the training data with your model so you know which feature vectors correspond to which states. Okay, let's just assume you could do that. That's not quite how we do it, but bear with me for a moment. So now you know that, let's say, vector 57, vector 103, and vector 256 corresponds to state 7. Now you want to estimate the output probability, the parameters of the output probability distribution for state 7. Well, all you really have to do, if you're using a single mixture component, is take the mean of those vectors, and that's going to be the mean of that model. Then you would take the variance of those parameters, and that's going to be the covariance of your model, if you had a single mixture. That's all we're really talking about. However, if you have multiple mixture components, then you have to do a little bit more work, because you want to ask the question, what's the best combination of, let's say, two Gaussians that could have produced these three feature vectors? So there's a little bit of an optimization there. But what you're going to actually do to estimate the coefficients is because it's the sum of the mixed, because the Gaussian mixture model is the sum of the Gaussians, all you're really going to end up doing is asking the question, if these three vectors were produced by the first mixture component, what must be the parameters of that component? If these three vectors were produced by the second mixture component at that state, what are the probabilities? So you can actually independently estimate the parameters of each one of the mixture distributions. And then all you have to do is weight them, and you weight them essentially by the probability that those three vectors could have been produced by either one of those two components. And since the weights have to sum to one, it's fairly straightforward. So, maximization of the Q function with respect to the output distributions requires differentiation with respect to the parameters of the Gaussian, the mu's, and the sigmas. Now, the derivation of that's a little bit lengthy, but it results in a very interesting equation, which is that the new estimate for the mean is just the sum of the actual feature vectors weighted by this parameter psi for the jth state for the kth mixture component summed over time divided by the sum of that overall over time. So we have essentially a term that reflects the total, what we call occupancy for that state, the total number of times we're in that state and we produce the kth mixture component divided by, and that's the denominator, and then in the numerator we have that term summed over, essentially that term serves as a weighting of the feature vector. So this psi is the probability that we produced the sequence of feature vectors, V superscript T, that we were in state J at time T, and that we produced the kth mixture component at time T. And then that's divided by the total probability that the model produced this state sequence. And this probability can be written in terms of our alphas from time 1 to T minus 1 times Aij, the transition from state I to state J at time T, times the corresponding mixture component weight, times the mixture component output probability, times beta, describing what happens now from time T plus 1 out to time capital T, the end of the sequence. And then this term on the bottom is essentially just the sum over all states of the alphas at time T. So this has a fairly straightforward implementation in terms of the alphas, the betas, the A's, C's, and B's. And that's why when we actually do this HMM training, we accumulate essentially these alphas and the betas during training. And then once we've got those for all the training data, we can then update the parameters using those alphas and betas. The mixture coefficients are re-estimated using a similar equation where we now have the sum. We have essentially in the denominator the we sum over all mixture components, and then in the numerator we have just the kth mixture component. So the weight for the kth mixture component at state J is just essentially a ratio of the number of times we took the kth mixture component at that state divided by the total number of times we took any mixture component at that state. So that's so the adoption of the continuous distribution model doesn't change the way we compute the A's. All that it does is it introduces additional re-estimation equations for the means, the variances, and the mixture coefficients. It's very common because this is potentially a symmetric matrix, there's a large number of parameters associated with this matrix. And you have one of these for each mixture component. So it's very common in, at least in audio and most applications I've seen, when you have a large number of states, to assume that that mixture, that covariance matrix is diagonal. Basically assume that the features are decorrelated. And the only thing we want to take into account when we make this diagonal is the variances of each component of the feature vector. So what this, with the variance weighting approach, you can think of this covariance matrix at a state as simply, it's a principal components analysis essentially that just tries to normalize, if you think about all the data that gets mapped to that state, that covariance, if it's approximated as a diagonal covariance matrix, it's just going to take the, it's going to weight the features by their variances so that we're essentially normalizing the features like we do in principal components analysis. It's also common in, I don't think we'll talk about this semester, but in the speech class we talk about this. One of the really interesting ways we can reduce parameters is to try to share these Gaussians and these covariances, share these means and these covariances across all the states. So one of the things that we'll do after we train the model, we'll actually try to cluster or reduce the number of Gaussians using a decision tree type clustering approach, where we base that clustering on the same likelihood, the alphas and the betas, that we compute. We essentially cluster the Gaussians that look similar from a statistical point of view. We may talk about that later in the semester. I don't remember if I have a lecture on that. But there's a very nice information theoretic way to cluster these Gaussians using the likelihood information so that you retain only the Gaussians that are most probable to occur. And you can sort of set a threshold and say, well, I want to keep 1,000 or I want to keep 10,000. So give me the 10,000 most probable Gaussians. And that's another interesting way that we transform the traditional clustering problem, which is typically not non-statistical, to we integrate it into the HMM framework and we do it on a statistical basis. So now what we've got, we've essentially got our HMM machinery. We've got a, let me go back to the picture of our, we essentially have a model which consists of states. We've got transition probabilities describing how you can transition from one state to the next. We've got Gaussian mixture distributions at each one of these states. And associated with those mixture distributions are the means, the covariances, and the weights. And those are all those parameters we have to estimate from the data itself. And the principal way that we do that estimation is to, as the data comes in, we run the forward-backward algorithm and we compute the alphas and the betas and we retain those for every state in the system. And then once we're done with processing the data, we take those alphas and betas, apply these equations and re-estimate the, we re-estimate the parameters of the model based on those alphas and betas. So the training actually runs pretty, relatively speaking, it runs pretty fast because you're essentially computing alphas and betas for every state in the system as a function of time. Okay, so that's the end of the section in this chapter on hidden Markov models. And what we talked about at the end of last class was how to actually apply these things. So I think There we go. Okay. So, I think we can see that, right? Okay. Application. Seriously? What? So what? Let's go around the room and talk about what areas you're working in for your research or for your graduate studies here. Why don't we start in the front? And if it's undecided, that's fine too. Okay. On what? UAVs? So sort of image processing? Okay. So there's a lot of, there's obviously a lot of pattern recognition that goes into the image targeting and tracking and all that kind of thing. So a very analogous problem to speech recognition is the problem of finding images, finding objects like buildings and cars and trucks and people that you might want to shoot at from UAVs and things like that. They also, of course, do crop surveillance and a lot of agriculture stuff now. But there's a lot of interest in the active targeting capabilities of these devices. There's also another sort of related problem is that we're seeing more interest in these days is this whole idea of what's called swarm intelligence. When you have a group of UAVs and you want them to function as a unit, how can you create software and intelligence so that they can all work together and one operator can manage many of these units? So the units have to be a little bit smart because an operator can't fly all of them in real time. So it's a little bit like Star Wars, but it's literally true that you can have one person control maybe a dozen of these things because they're able to do a number of things autonomously. There's also, I guess, another related problem is following map information and correlating map information with the terrains that you're seeing. So can you follow a road? You see a road and you try to then correlate that with the map so you know where you are on the map with your GPS and with the road and all that kind of stuff. Okay? So one of the hot areas in compression in the past 10 years, if you look at the progression of compression algorithms over the past 30 years, they essentially make more and more use of knowledge about the domain and try to sort of model objects within the domain, for example, when you're doing image compression. Okay? In what? What type of problem? Okay. Yeah. In what? Denoising? Yeah. Right. So we won't talk about that in this class, but it's possible to have at your state. Thus now we've talked about what are called generative models, where you're essentially modeling the statistics at each state by a Gaussian mixture distribution. But you can also factor that out and have a mixture distribution for the signal and a mixture distribution for the noise. And then you can try to estimate the parameters of these two independently. And we did that about 10 years ago or so. People started looking at that for speech recognition, and it gave kind of media, it didn't give significant improvements, but it was something people were very excited about because of this idea that you could actually build a system that denoises. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. Okay. Okay. So tell us more. So what's your signal? One. So you don't. So essentially, you don't know where in the signal your information is. So you do not have to do segmentation as part of that problem then? Yeah, you don't. So you said you're operating on a one-dimensional signal, but you don't have to locate the target of interest within that signal, if I understand what you're saying. So one of the problems with... Okay, so you do have to do segmentation. Okay, because one of the problems in speech recognition is your signal, you know, if you think about a typical voice response system, the system says, you know, please say your number now or please say your phrase now. So you at some point you start recording, and then typically the system will do some form of voice activity detection and decide when you've stopped talking, and it will then terminate recording. But you don't know within this signal where the words begin and end. And that's actually part of what we use HMM for. And I want to talk a little bit about that today because I think that'll help clarify some of the mechanics of how we apply HMM training. So it sounds like you have the same kind of problem. Yeah, so we have a saying about that in speech processing, which is segmentation is the hardest part of the problem. Finding where words begin and end, especially in noisy environments, is the hardest part of the problem. If you get the segmentation right, you usually get very high performance classification. Most of the time you make an error in classification, it's because you missegmented the data. Yeah. Okay, left. Thank you. is the energy level? Right. Okay. And again, do you have, so along the horizontal, do you have segmentation issues? No, right? Because you're so that's more of a static classification problem. Okay. Right. 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 Okay, so what application do we want to talk about? And I don't need to be convinced to talk about speech, you know that. But I'm open, whatever you want me to talk about. I'm sorry? All right, so, okay, so it sounds like you want me to talk about speech. Okay, so here our problem is that you call into your automated voice attendant, and it says, here's your choices, please speak now. So you speak, you start here. And you speak at some point. Sometimes you actually prefer to speak over the announcement. That's always interesting because then we have to use echo cancellation to remove the announcement, which is an interesting thing in itself. But and then when you stop speaking, what the system actually is doing is it's monitoring your energy level, and it uses a sort of an algorithm that monitors energy as a function of time, and once energy drops below a certain threshold, it waits a little bit longer and then it shuts off. Okay, so this is what, so what you get as training data are a lot of different waveforms. Okay. So we want to build a hidden Markov model-based system to recognize what words you're speaking. Not just choose which one of these waveforms you spoke, but actually recognize the words that you're speaking. Okay, and that's a little bit different than the static classification problem because we don't know in what order you speak the words. We don't know where they occur in the waveform. And we're going to use HMMs to figure all that out automatically. Okay, so what's the first thing that we need to do? So I give you a terabyte of data. You know, it's hundreds of thousands of people calling in with this data. So these are sample data files. They could be MP3s. They could be waves, whatever. So what's the first thing we need to do if we want to apply continuous distribution hidden Markov models? Even before training, there are a couple things we have to do, we have to worry about. Well, that's an interesting point. The data, we have the data as sample data files, which means we know the speech amplitude as a function of time. We will not normalize the data. It would be really tempting to normalize the data, except that energy is actually very useful in speech because one of the ways we tell what sounds are being spoken is by their difference in energy. So we won't actually normalize all the... You could, for example, normalize the waveforms to have an average energy level of 1. That would actually not be... get better performance if you don't do that. But there's an important step that we have to do before we can even apply our Gaussian. About what? That's another good point. But even before labeling... labeling actually is a very good point. We will have to label the data. But prior to that, if we want to apply Gaussian distribution modeling to this, we have to somehow convert this sample data into something that matches our Gaussians. Well, our Gaussians have mean vectors and covariance vectors. Right now, we have sample data. So what's the first thing that we have to do? What? No? We have to convert the sample data to, starts with an F. No, features, right? We've got to get this thing into some kind of vectors as a function of time. So I won't, I think I actually showed a slide on that at the beginning of the semester, but what we'll essentially do is to take features every 10 milliseconds. We'll use a 25-millisecond analysis window centered every 10 milliseconds. And we'll take Kepstra coefficients, we'll differentiate them once, differentiate them twice, and we'll build a feature vector that has Kepstra coefficients, derivatives, and second derivatives. You don't have to really worry about that. But what will come out of that then is that every 10 milliseconds, we're going to get a sequence of vectors, right? And the difference between these in time is 10 milliseconds. So we're going to get 100 vectors a second. Now, concurrent with that, there's this issue of labeling. To do training, we're going to need to know something about the truth. What is the right answer, so to speak? So, the way we like to do that, the way we as PhD researchers like to do that is you go hire a bunch of graduate students. You strap them to their chairs in the lab, and you tell them they can't leave until they've labeled about 100 hours of data. So you basically have to get labor to go and listen to the data. We actually use undergrads for this. And what we're going to need for our work today, we're not going to ask them to actually mark where every phoneme begins and ends. That would be really nice to get that information. But that would require a linguist or somebody skilled at linguistics, and that would take a lot of time. All that we're really going to want to know is what words were spoken. And remember, as I'm talking about speech, this can really be any application. So words could be something general. Words could be objects like trucks and buildings and windows, or words can be actual words. So what we'll actually get from the data is labeling in terms of words. And you'll notice here that part of the problem we're going to face is for a segment like this, we may not even know how many words are in that segment. The labelers may tell us, well, there's three words in this segment. But words are essentially going to be our classes. Our goal is going to be to recognize words. That's the pattern recognition problem, if you will. Now, to build our HMMs, we don't know the order in which words occur. But we're going to want a model for each word. Now, we could build one HMM per word. We could decide, for example, that this kind of an HMM is going to represent a word. What's wrong with this approach from a complexity point of view? There's an awful lot of models. Why? Because in the English language, there may be 250,000 words. Even in normal conversation, you may use several thousand words. So that means we're going to need several thousand words. Well, if you want to do large vocabulary speech recognition, we're going to need hundreds of thousands of word models. That's not good. Fortunately, language has some structure to it. And this is true of whether we're talking about English or Chinese, and I'm guessing in this room we've got English speakers and Chinese speakers. Any other languages? Korean? And Korean, I think, is pretty close to Chinese from what I recall. It's sort of halfway between Japanese and Chinese. I don't remember the details of Korean, but Chinese is kind of syllable-based. English is sort of syllable-based. I don't remember Korean. Is it, does one character in Korean map to a syllable, or is it more like Japanese that you've got multiple characters mapping to multiple sounds? Several characters will map to a expression, right? Yeah, I think that, if I remember right, Korean is like Japanese that way. So, in languages like English, and most languages in general, words and syllables can actually be represented in terms of phonemes. So what we're actually going to do is to let these HMM models represent phonemes. And we're going to then have what's called a lexicon. And again, you can think of this as a general concept where each word is mapped in terms of particular phonemes. Now, actually, what we can do for the lexicon is we can actually model a word as a hidden Markov model and let these phoneme symbols actually be states in that model. But typically what's done right now is we just model the lexicon in a simple way. We have a list that says this word maps to these phonemes. Well, now what we actually do in speech recognition is we don't just have a model for the phoneme. We actually have a model for the phoneme in context. So we actually have models where we model essentially sequences of three phonemes. The left context, the right context, and the center context. So there's 40 phonemes in English, but there's a potential for 40 times 40 times 40 combinations of three phonemes, which is something like 64,000, I think. Typically, we use about 8,000 of those, but all of them don't occur. Not every phoneme can follow every other phoneme. So we have about 8,000 models that represent, for example, P sub 8 with the left context of P sub 3 and P sub 27 is the right context. These are what are called context-dependent phonemes. But for the purpose of this class, we can just think of those models as three-state hidden Markov models. And at each state, we'll use about somewhere between 16 and 64 mixtures. That's a lot. 64 is a lot, because if you think about it, we have a 39-dimensional feature vector, which means each mixture component has a 39-dimensional mean. And we use variance weighting, so it has a 39-dimensional variance. So that's 78 parameters associated with each mixture component. If we use 64 mixtures, we have 64 times 78 at each state. If we have 8,000 three-state models, you have 24,000 times that. You easily get up into 10 million parameters. But for the purposes of this class, let's think about the fact that we have these three-state models for phones. We have Gaussian mixture distributions at each phone. And what I'll talk about next time then is how we kind of put all this together so we can train. And we can actually train with just the words. We don't need to know where they begin and end. And I'll talk about that also. Okay, see you on Friday.